This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
It's been an eventful week in terms of cases, what's going to be happening, what people are saying once they've been convicted, and we're going to be talking about that. Alec Murtaugh being the top of the list, Corey Richens sentencing, we're going to get to that as well. But let's start with old Alec Murtaugh, because we are back at literally square one. Welcome back to 2022, somewhere around there. That's about where we've been placing ourselves at now, because Alec Murtaugh is now an alleged murderer. He is not the convicted murderer of his wife and son. Retrial, very likely going to be coming down the pike at some point this year, next year, following year. I don't know. We'll get to all of that. But it's going to be a very, very different trial than trial number one. And somebody who holds the key to the future of Alec Murtaugh and what his legacy will be, what the history books say about him, whether or not he's a murderer or just a financial fraudster, is his very own son, Buster Murtaugh. He sat behind his father every day of that first trial, told the jury he didn't believe his dad could do this. Then Alec got convicted and Buster vanished, and rightfully so. This is not an episode. I have nothing negative to say about Buster. Buster is a victim of his father and a victim of his family. He also holds a lot of cards here based on what he expresses in terms of if he believes his father killed his brother and his mother. He's been married. He quietly moved on. But Buster, if he still believes his father, he's the most powerful witness the defense has. If he doesn't, the prosecution just found someone who can look the jury in the eye and say Alec Murtaugh is capable of killing his own family. Here to discuss on Friday, as always, a great panel for us. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, and Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, host of the podcast Break the Case. Be sure to check it out on YouTube and wherever you get podcasts. Welcome to both of you. Prosecution's theory is family annihilation. At least it was in trial one. Alec was cornered and desperate and destroyed the people closest to him. But Jen, you, I think, have even pointed out on X that killing three is harder than killing two. And Maggie probably wouldn't have bought a story about Paul being gunned down if Buster was also dead. Does the fact that Buster is alive actually break the state's own motive theory before they even get to the opening statements? The fact that he's still alive and breathing, is that an angle they could take this round?
I don't think really. And that's, this is why, when you look at what Buster didn't bring to the table that Pawpaw did. In other words, Paul, who he called Pawpaw, was damaged. Yeah. I know it was a little sick, but he had a boating accident under the influence that resulted in the death. Mm-hmm. And that death brought all sorts of not only shame to the family, but financial woes to the family. And you add on top of that, Maggie, who, again, there were no life insurance policies on anybody, but control of their estate, you know, control of what would and wouldn't be done with money. And you add that all together, and it makes sense to me that he's just not going to get away with killing all three. Although, believe me, I think he had hoped he could figure out a way to annihilate all three. He only was able to annihilate two.
Yeah, it's interesting on the Buster thing. I keep looking at different ways. And one of the things that popped in my mind when looking at Buster and his kind of, I wouldn't say chaotic responses necessarily, but he's had a lot of emotional type responses where he could be beneficial to both sides. And in my experience, and I'm wondering if this is your experience too, do you see him as a handling issue for either prosecution or defense, like we have with sources sometimes?
Yeah, it's such a great question. You know, you look at him, and I think that he definitely served the defense last time from the standpoint of you always want to look where the surviving relative, they're going to stand on things. And I don't know if we're going to see him in the same posture. I wouldn't be surprised to see him not even show up, not even be in the courtroom until subpoenaed, because he will be subpoenaed.
Yeah, I definitely am seeing him as a potential credibility issue, either that both sides could attack his credibility because of it as well. And so that's why I would be leery of introducing him on either side, because again, outside out looking in, you know, you don't know, because we're not him, not close to him, but it's a kid's glove kind of time, I think, with assessing where he's actually at, and can he be consistent with what he presents, and can we actually defend him on cross from the credibility issues, I would think.
I think you're exactly right there, because if he were to take the stand, let's say in theory here, and we have no idea. Right now we know from reports allegedly that he's furious that this is happening. He's called Alec a selfish old man. And he has certainly kept his distance. We've heard some of the phone calls between him and his dad over the last couple of years from prison, Alec being in prison. And it hasn't been necessarily the loving son, father-son relationship that one may think. Feels very contentious, and rightfully so. I mean, he's forever tainted by what his family has done. So if he were to take the stand, and if he were to take the stand on the part of defense, in theory, he could basically be impeached in one way or another, I would think. Or they'll certainly take a chance at impeaching his testimony from the side of Alec because of his former testimony that was pro-dad, pro-Alec, and it all depends exactly how it's presented and what is presented. But the reality is, he could have, in the last 3 years, ventured to a very different conclusion than he had at that moment in time when his dad was on trial. Sitting there, the time to sit back, to look at everything. After abusive situations, after coming out of an environment that was controlled, all of that, it takes years sometimes to look back and go, oh God, that was that, was that? And you don't know it. And sometimes it's obvious things to others looking in, but not to those closest. He could have a very different opinion. Those opinions, those thoughts, those memories, when put together, if presented at trial, could paint a very different picture of Alec Murdaugh. And it could be a very powerful one. But again, yeah, is that a lever either side, you know, the defense is willing to pull, even if he's willing to do it? Because it could backfire spectacularly, could it not?
Well, first of all, to your point about it taking family and loved ones time to come around, I'm going to give you just the best analogy that I can think of, and that's Lacey Peterson. If you look at Lacey's mom, I mean, she always stood up. Everybody stood up initially for Scott. Uh-huh. It just takes, when you love somebody, when you're there at Thanksgivings, when they're the, you know, to be father of your unborn grandson, nobody wants to believe that they could ever do these horrific crimes, right? So it makes sense to me that Buster would have supported his dad. I mean, that's the one last thing he has left. He has no mom. He has no brother. He's only got his father left, and you don't want to believe it. I believe he could be a breakout powerhouse witness for the prosecution if he has something meaningful to say. And I think that exactly how I explained why initially he was behind his dad could be used to mitigate what he said earlier.
Yeah, and I agree on the side, if he decides to do the prosecution, you know, for the prosecution side and testify on that side. And I'm just looking at this pattern of behavior that we've seen since Alec was convicted and sentenced. He's pulled back, he's been restrained. And so we have a pattern of behavior of disconnected and moving on, like Tony said. And so then you got to ask, so we keep talking in terms of defense and prosecution, them using him, but now let's reverse it. What's in it for Buster to want to do this? I'm hard pressed. And the only thing I can really think of that he would get out of doing this, unless he's subpoenaed and he has to, would be if he is part of his therapeutic healing was to do something like this, which is maybe. I'm thinking he's most likely would follow his same pattern behavior that he's done. And that is, you know, he's expressed anger that this is happening. Maybe that anger, again, is conjecture, is because, God dang, I got to go through this again. I'm done. I'm moving on. You know, this guy's an ass. He's behind bars. You know, why do I got to suffer? So he might not want to do it at all on either side because he's just trying to move on, like we've been saying.
Yeah, you know, we don't know Buster, as you guys mentioned, and we don't know him. But imagine that realization, and you see this with victim family members when they realize a family member's responsible and they finally come to Jesus. They are pissed. And he might be ready to say his truth, you know, all the little signs that he had, that he might just want to be ready to just come forth and then also clear his name in a sense, you know,
distance himself.
I might have cheated on, you know, some stuff in school, but remember, you know, there's that piece of it. I just think that's a character.
Possibility of rebranding. Yeah, sorry, Tony.
Yeah, I mean, and the cheating stuff. You actually reminded me of that the other day in your tweet. It took me a moment because you said the cheating stuff in parentheses, and I'm like, what is she talking about? I'm like, oh yeah, the cheating stuff at school. Because at first I thought like relationship wise, I'm like, what are we going here? And I don't know if anybody's been thinking of that anymore. Obviously, the big thing that people think about with Buster were the allegations that were made about Stephen Smith, which have been debunked, and but still, you know, forever will plague him because it's the Murdaugh name and all that. Again, I'm in no way it's saying there's anything to do with that, but it certainly is something where if he took a super strong stance against his family, I think that would be powerful. And it would probably go a long ways to go against the detractors and the people that still stand by that whole story and go, see, I think he had something to do with it. I mean, he's not going to win in every arena. There's still going to be something to go, see, he's doing this to cover it up even more. And, you know, everybody's going to have a reason for everything. But I think that would be powerful. But there's this too. And tell me what your thoughts are. It is a family name. Alec Murdaugh has Richard Alexander Murdaugh is now there's a third Richard Alexander Murdaugh, and it's Buster's kid who was born after the trial, who was born after everything. I don't want to make a deal about the kid, but the name itself, Buster felt strong enough to name his child after his father. That says something.
Well, it's a long held family name.
Yeah, but still your dad.
I agree with you, you know, at least make it a middle name. I don't know.
I mean, it is. It's Richard Alexander Murdaugh, but he's now Richard Alexander Murdaugh III is the child. So, I mean, I get it. Legacy is hurt, but at the same point, I don't know, maybe break free at some point, but I don't know. Families are strong things. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it might be an indication that he will stay steadfast. Like I said, I could see him showing up in the courtroom at all, being subpoenaed by the defense and giving the same type of testimony. But you never know. People change, and he could have even changed after he had his job.
Yeah.
You know, it really comes down to what he thinks of the name, why he's choosing that name, just because he chose a name. a trap we all fall into a lot of times is what we would do in those situations. And that's, you know, one thing I enjoy in these moments is doing our best to reverse it, understand the thought process. Granted, I think it's stupid because if his intent is to distance himself from his family and break free of that name. But, you know, I mean, I know some people are heavy into genetics, heavy into genealogy, heavy into the heraldry of their name, their backgrounds, even with blemishes. And if he sees his dad as a one-time blemish, maybe he wants to hold on to that name because, like Jen said, it's a family historical type name. I don't know. Understanding that thought process, and this is what really prosecution, if they want to use him, is going to have to really deeply more understand his thought process behind that, because that's something defense could bring up as well, or who knows. So family tradition follows the Murdaugh pattern. Alex Murdaugh's full name is Richard Alexander Sr. Buster is Jr. Baby is third. Trip is common nickname for the third. It is a family tradition.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it is after his name too. I mean, I don't want to admit that. That is part of the story.
It's interesting. It makes you think. You know, and that's why I love, you know, the thing that popped in my mind this morning as the three of us are doing it. It's like we're doing, like we do all the time, we're doing big thought experiments on what if this, what if this, what if this, what's this mean, what's this mean, what's this mean, all these different angles to try to understand. basically, the greatest challenge of this is, how is prosecution going to move forward with a new trial and not be able to really cover it the way they did last time, using the big lever of the financial crime aspect of it? And what now? I mean, you know, you still have two dead people and someone who's now just accused of this, who it's really messy. And that's why we're talking to Eric Faddish yesterday. Was really interesting. And I can't wait to get Bob's take on it as well. But it's a lot of messiness in here.
Yeah, the layers of messiness run very, very deep. And I should note, in the next week or two, we're going to have Alec Murdaugh's housekeeper back on with us, Blanca Simpson, get her reaction to all this. The other night, it was their camp that actually texted me before all this came down and said, by the way, this is happening. And I know Blanca, they reached out the other week and said, can she come on when this happens? Like, yes, she can. I'm looking forward to that conversation. So we'll get some more insight from someone who was right there at Moselle when this stuff was happening.
And it can be really powerful, too.
Can we have run on a Friday with you? Maybe. I don't know. That'd be fun.
And great angles. I mean, so, you know, because this is new angles that the prosecution wasn't able to cover last time. So you have the housekeeper and you have Buster that might be on the side of the prosecutionist side. It's going to bring a whole new angle and whole new different types of testimony that it's going to really could potentially be even more damning. But again, on the personal side of Alec, and you know, the more the horrendous things going on behind it, but also could it show the pattern of behavior of escalation as well, which because again, you got to go beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, for conviction of this. So it's going to be a challenging road.
It is, no matter what. Your thoughts in the comment section, Substack, YouTube, leave them there for us, and we'll continue that conversation there. We'll continue on here. The first time around the prosecution and the trial of Alec Murdaugh, they buried Alec Murdaugh under 12 hours of stolen money and defrauded clients. The Supreme Court just said that can't happen again. They gave conditions. They can't say it can't completely happen, but they gave conditions. So now, Creighton Waters, if he's going to be the prosecuting attorney here, walks into a courtroom and has to convict on the actual evidence itself, the physical case, the same case where the crime scene sat in the rain, family walked through it, police walked through it, sled walked through it, no murder weapon was ever recovered, no DNA was found on the defendant, and the housekeeper says she flagged a suspicious vehicle to sled, and they blew it off, told her to go get mental help. Harputalin is already signaling he's going on the offense. He told reporters the reversal will bring reluctant witnesses out of the woodwork. Round two isn't just about whether Alec did it. It might be about whether anyone seriously investigated the possibility that someone else could have. With us to break it all down, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, and also Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, to help us discuss what's going on here. Jen Blanca Simpson, who's been on the show, is going to be on again very soon, says she told SLED about an unidentified white truck at Moselle on the day of the killings, parked near where Paul kept his firearms. And she says they dismissed it. She later identified it more specifically in private interviews than she ever actually did on the stand. You've been involved in federal cases for almost three decades here. When a witness gives you a vehicle near a weapons storage area hours before a double homicide, and doesn't run that down, it makes, I think, a lot of people question the thoroughness of the investigation. Do you think there is going to be a lot of exposure this time around on just how unthorough this investigation was?
Well, the defense gets to have hindsight.
Sure.
And hindsight is a beautiful thing, but so does the prosecution. But I think in this case, it's going to benefit far greater the defense. And yes, in answer to your question, that's a pathetic response. Whenever there is any vehicle that is mentioned and described, if they're able to nail it down to that exact day and time, remember, sometimes people remember things and I have no doubt it happened, but they could be mistaken about the day or the time or exactly when that happened. Nevertheless, you've got to run it down. There should be some camera footage or some information related to why a van would be there. But I don't recall that information related in proximity to when this happened, meaning like hour, you know, minute, hour, tight proximity.
I believe she, according to her, and I'm just going off of memory here right now, it was like the day of that this happened, that there was this vehicle that was going around. She has a lot of things that she witnessed and that she told to police that never even made it into the trial. A lot of it's in her book. That because eventually it seems SLED, in her perception, dismissed her, told her to go get mental health help. And I don't think it was in a way of like, you've been through a lot. Like, it would be good to go talk to somebody. I think it was more like, yeah, you're crazy, go get some help. That's the way, at least I believe, she has interpreted the response from SLED with the valuable information she had. And she is one of the most valuable people in this case. It's very troubling to me that she was dismissed allegedly in the way that she was by the investigators for someone being that close with their finger literally, on the pulse. I mean, I'm not trying to make a weird reference here, but on the pulse of how that family operates is my point.
It's going to be important to get the other side of that story.
Yeah.
And I wholeheartedly believe everything that she's saying, what she said was coming back to her, the words are coming back to her, because how things sound to the person receiving, especially in these high stress situations, compared to actually what is being done on the other side, can be extremely incongruent. And I guarantee—I'm not speaking for you, Jim—but I guarantee you've probably seen cases like this, because I've had people when I was in another field office outside of New York on work in counterintelligence that became sources of mine that were extremely grateful that I was their handler and they were going to be cooperating, working together with me because, quote unquote, the guy that showed up before you was a jackbooted thug carrying weapons and threatened my life and if I didn't cooperate. Mm-hmm. The guy's a really good guy and he didn't do that. I actually got video of him knocking on the front door, being very congenial. But again, that reverse context, and you can't argue ever context because that's how it's perceived by the other person. So that's why it's really important to get both sides. And now sure. Also the hindsight issue is also really critical. If you want to, I guarantee you this too, it's easier, like Jen said, for defense. But if you want to start picking apart how law enforcement did things wrong in hindsight, you will always find it because there's always the critical vulnerability in every operation and every investigation. That's human beings, mm-hmm. which are not perfect, which are fallible. And especially when you have, I would project probably name confirmation bias going on in this one, on any side of it. And because you, in this part of South Carolina, or really in any place, you have power brokers. And when you start having power brokers that wield influence over others, there's going to be confirmation issues that come into play that you have to overcome as well. So there's a lot of messiness going on there. But that 100%. They would have and should have and hopefully will at least now run down the leads that the housekeeper's given, because that's a lot of really critical information that could come to play. Anyway, just my rant on it all.
Harpootlin, like I said at the intro here, he said something very specific after the ruling, and that this reversal will give them access to reluctant witnesses. And if people don't come forward voluntarily, they'll use subpoena. What's different this round that they didn't do in round one? I mean, is there more people to call? Is there other angles? Did they not go to reluctant witnesses round one? What's your thought here? Is there more up the sleeve of Mr. Harpootlin that for whatever reason was not brought onto the big stage the first time?
Well, I've always said the number one mistake they made, and I understand that Murdaugh was pushing for this, was him testifying. I make this analogy with him. He was a dog on a wet linoleum floor, sliding around up there, couldn't get anything right. He made no sense. He stepped in it with that video, and that video is never going to go away. That video needs to be the number one piece of evidence, because that Snapchat showing Alec at the dog kennels at the time of the murder absolutely ruins the case for them. And remember, just because it's a new trial, it doesn't mean the old trial didn't happen from the standpoint mm-hmm. of there's testimony that is going to be there that you can't erase. people can't change their minds without being discredited by the what they said the first time. So it's not like that evidence doesn't exist anymore. And I think they'll keep him off the stand. But he might be so arrogant and psychopathic that he might insist on going on again. I think it'll be a huge mistake.
It'll be really interesting because he's had time to reflect as well and try to smooth out his performance because I guarantee, you know, he's a performer. You know, people that can commit these acts, you know, when you're edging higher on a psychopathic scale with a lack of empathy, not because, again, not diagnosed and all that, but when you deal with someone that can do these horrendous things, innocent until proven guilty, but he was proven guilty once, so this is the retrial, trying round two. You know, if you start dealing with someone, at least on the financial crime side, where you can so abhorrently take advantage of another human being, whether it's through violence or depriving them of a means of living, this is someone that's high on the psychopathic scale in the sense of they have zero empathy, and so they're mimicking the behaviors of others. And so that was an act. When you're seeing these things, it's not real. They're mimicking what they think the world wants to see or needs to see, and they're trying to make it congruent. So he might try to get better at that. Maybe being off of cocaine for the last, or whatever drugs he was taking, for the last opioids, 3 years is going to help him, you know, so who knows, but yeah.
The thing is, and yes, and that's the big crux of, I think, the whole retrial is they had like 12 days of evidence for the financial crimes that very thoroughly and factually showed what a manipulative, narcissistic, self-centered monster Alec Murdaugh is with money, and where what he stole from and who he stole from, stealing from disabled people. I mean, just it's insane. It's horrible. And at the end of it, you walk away going, yeah, he's totally capable of killing his family if he's able
part
to
of
do
the arc.
That.
Yep.
But if you pull all that out and you don't get it and you get like a very condensed version of it, that impact isn't there. That backstory doesn't exist. So you're not already there with him by the time you get to Alec on the stand shooting snot out of his nose, saying that he was that it was the Baba and bleh, whatever the hell he's saying. All of that doesn't have the lead up, the build up. So
but
is
maybe
it,
the son and the housekeeper part of that arc now?
Yeah.
People like that.
I wonder how much going into this is going to be a different story from the jump. Because in trial one, we didn't know about Alec, what we did with the video. We knew he was down there. We were going to see how he was going to explain it. And he explained it. He said he lied. And he was down there the whole time. And it was drugs that made him lie. If they're going in from the jump on this one, that he was down there, it's not all of the trial, all 6 weeks of it, saying that he wasn't, and then suddenly it changes at the moment of truth. If day one, yeah, I was down there, but you lied about it early on. Yeah, we've already established that I did, and here's why. I mean, you can't spend 6 weeks going, yeah, you lied about it. Yeah, we already established that, but this we're moving on from that. It changes the whole trajectory of the case. It changes the whole acceptance of the evidence of where he was and why he was there. And I think they're going to have to do a lot more explaining beyond just the dramatic moment that we had in trial one with Alec shooting snot out of his face of why he was there. They're going to have a lot more time to go down that road. And it really could change. I mean, who knows what sort of stories they're going to come up with here with that round. How do you think that's going to play out, Jen, with now that's a fact going in on day one of this next trial?
Well, first of all, you make a great point. You know, for anybody who's watched what I think is the best thriller ever called The Sixth Sense, where you go through
yes.
at the end, you get this huge reveal. Anytime you've watched a movie like that, that is the problem with this trial, is the reveals there. And in the other trial, it had the biggest impact. And they're not going to have that anymore. The other thing is the kennels don't exist. Remember, we heard from jurors that said that was a huge part.
Yeah, right. Yeah, walking the ground.
They are not there anymore to see that proximity, right? No. The close proximity and him there and how he couldn't have walked back from the house and everything. I mean, I think that is going to be catastrophic that they don't have that. As far as their approach, if I were them, I'm going to defense, meaning I am going to have an alternative suspect, and I'm going to try.
That's the big one. Yeah.
Who do you? But Do you name it? Do you have a named alternative? Do you have to name an alternative as who it is, or just mystery person?
I think they're going to either do one of two things. I think they're going to go the drug route because of his, you know, drug. And by the way, Robin, if you don't think he's doing hooch in food.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the fruit hooch?
Lemons rolling
toilet around. Yeah, the toilet hooch you make in the jail, yeah.
Oh my God. Alex, a bartender now.
He's probably hooching it up. But anyway, that could be clouding what he ends up doing. So he might take the stand. But back to this, I think they'll have somebody, not a person, but definitely they might go the drug route. I tell you, if Buster turns on them, they could even try to turn on Buster. I think it's going to be ridiculous and hard to do, but they could try.
Yeah, the alternate, I know they'd like to go down the alternate person route, but even after this amount of time, keeping someone silent with other people knowing for this period of time, and especially someone who's as self-serving and narcissistic as Alex is, he would have thrown someone under the bus, I would think, at this point in time. So I really think trying to introduce a third party that it could have been or that someone's witty enough, I mean, it just... It's such a stretch because go ahead, Tony. What?
He was an attorney though too. You know, like he has some, and I'm wondering if that's the difference here. They were all counting on, because they had a pretty strong card with Becky Hill. I think they knew the odds are pretty good here. We're going to get a retrial. So maybe we should all shut the F up and not leak a bunch of stuff from prison. That's not going to help us. Let's hold on to it for the big show number two. I'm wondering how much of that was played in here too. And the fact that he was an attorney and that he has that sense about him, unlike someone like Corey Richens or something.
That's possible.
Well, the other thing is you have the boat aspect, right?
Yeah.
The whole death that happened and people that could have, and remember, he
what a broken person, right? And just, and there's this, and there's this, and there's this. Sorry, but you're right. Keep going.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. And he said that on his initial interview. Remember the spontaneous, do you have anybody that could? Well, actually, I do. My son was involved in exactly how people don't act when their whole life has been destroyed in front of them, with their wife being murdered with a rifle as she crawled away and was hunted, and their son having their head blown off. You don't say, well, you know who could have done it is the people that are upset about the boating accident. So he's already thrown out that little whisper of a possibility. They're going to look at it all and figure out what works best. That's what they'll do.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Well, an interesting aspect of it was when the when he was held, when he got shot in the car where the bullet grazed him.
Yep, that's the other one I was thinking of.
The initial thing he did when they were trying to do a sketch of who he was claiming did it, he was trying to do a sketch of one of the kids from the boating accident. That looks, well, at least that's the assumption, because the sketch who he described looks suspiciously like that, like he's still trying to set up that story. So it's who knows? I'm excited to see him on the stand again, hopefully, and hopefully maybe they go down a road that doesn't work. And at the end, he's like, oh, it's all because of the prison hooch, and a bad line in there, and it affected the brain of meeting amoebas in my head. And it, who knows where he's going to go with it. I look forward to impersonating Alec Murdaugh more because it's fun.
I'm excited to see him on the stand again, or just be in defense again, just to watch him squirm and be uncomfortable and lose. Yeah. Just knowing he's already in jail, and that's that's again, my only fear is that somehow or other, because I remember when he originally, after he's convicted of this and sentenced, and he pled on the financial crime aspect, we're like, why would he do that? That's interesting. Does he have something up his sleeve that he's going to do on the? I just hope that everything on the finance side stands so that no matter what, he's still in jail and he's probably going to die in jail. So that way you can watch him squirm and be, and tell it would just be so awesome to watch him lose miserably again.
No, the odds are there.
But it's until proven guilty.
Innocent until proven guilty. Yeah, we'll see.
Twice.
Yeah, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Let's move over to another case and a fun segment that I'm just calling now. WTF was that? The sentencing of Corey Richens. Because Corey Richens handed the words their words to, excuse me, Corey Richin's children handed their words to therapists because they still can't stand in the same room with her. Those words described locked doors, dead animals, a brother sneaking food to his sibling, shut away in his bedroom, and a childhood spent afraid. Every one of them asked for the same thing, keep her away forever. And then minutes later, Corey grabs the mic, stands up in the courtroom, delivers a 40-minute speech, didn't acknowledge a single thing those kids said, but said, you know what? I'm basically going to stalk you. I'm going to call you when you don't want me to. Someday I'm going to get out, and we're going to figure this out. It was a stunning little speech there. Jen, I'm just going to go to you on this. When you saw Corey give her 40-minute diatribe, what was your reaction?
She's not a mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's a monster.
Understatement, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for those mothers out there, there is something that transforms in you. I don't know about as a father, but I can tell you, holding a child 100%. And everything, I always say, and it's nothing against my husband because I love him dearly, but you never know love until you have a child. There's something about you and your selfishness that dies out.
Yep.
And your first thought is your child. It's a weird, like, umbilical cord connection that you always have. It's weird. It's like you can still feel when they're sad, when they're 300 miles away, and all of a sudden you call and they say, how did you know that this happened? And you say, I don't know. It's like so weird. This is almost a subhuman. But it spoke to what I would have expected. And we'll see what Robin has to say. But it's nothing that they described I wouldn't suspect, because people who do this is who they are and who they have been and the way they treat their children and people around them. So none of us should be surprised, to be honest. Yeah. I would have expected it.
So, Jen, I'm gonna double down on your mother's statements. One of the books I read a couple of years ago by Stephen Pressfield, he's the one who wrote Gates of Fire. He's written many things, and he talked about the Greeks, you know, defending, this is the Thermopylae, the 300 that people have seen in movies and stuff. The ancient Greeks talk about the bravest people in the world were not the 300, it was the mothers. And the mothers of all time, especially during those time periods, because these women willingly gave up their children with those kind of bonds, knowing that they're going to go into battle, knowing that they're going to be given then to the agogi to be trained, and that the bravest people in the world of that time and any time are actually mothers willing to sacrifice and support and do all those things. So hats off to that. And yeah, so when it comes to my impressions of Corey Richin's, I'm listening to this. First of all, I was telling Tony before the segment started that she says that word love a lot, and there's no way her definition of love has any resemblance to anyone else's in the world's definition of love, because it's way off for all the reasons you just said, Jen. And then I'm saying to myself, this was not what I was expecting or what you typically expect from a statement, you know, at sentencing. There again, typically no apology and all these things. You saw very self-centered, very victim mindset, very victim, you know. One of the statements I actually loved, she just basically said how the world's out to get you and they always will. Then she went through this list of people that she didn't lose and lost, but didn't even mention her husband, right? I thought that was interesting. This is it. Always someone out there to tear you down is exactly what she said. Yeah, if you're an ass, there are. But the thing that really struck me was her narrative throughout this. She had all these themes. And I said, where does someone who is so low on the empathy scale, because she's so high on psychopathy, where does she have the ability to really draw that from? So I did this deep research on it. She has these themes in here. And you know where her themes are? She couldn't remember it word for word because she had a ghostwriter, but all the themes that she touched on her statement came right from her children's book. She actually copied the children's book. I'm trying to pull up the four things they were. So there's the commonest thing I did. Here they are. So here's the themes that she had in her children's book. And this is what she did right there in her statement. Enduring presence. I will never leave, abandon you despite separation. Never failing love and family bonds. Be like dad. Positive role modeling and resilience and imperfections, mistakes and forgiveness. They make us who we are. That's exactly what she did. And that's what her book was. So she couldn't remember it word for word because she didn't write it. Her ghostwriter did, but she remembered the themes because that's what she's trying to peddle and sell. She put on a show.
It was a performance, as always. Yep. I mean, as it is with all people like that, it is always a performance, and she knew she was taking the stage, and she just kind of had her different numbers that she pulled up, like, oh, well, we're doing the book today, one of my greatest hits, and that's essentially how she went through it. I found it very telling and very interesting. I mean, her reactions were comical. I mean, I thought it was going to be a fairly unremarkable sentencing. It turned out to be very entertaining. Just her constant reactions to everything. It was Donna Adelson-ish in some ways, especially when, I mean, she's scoffing at the words of her children. She's scoffing at the words of her children's aunts and uncles, the people who are caring for these kids and helping them survive all of this. But then when it came to time for the Corey fan club, her flying monkeys to come up on stage and do their performance, oh my God, her reactions went from the scoffing to just pure, oh, she was soaking that shit in, because it's probably the last time anyone's ever going to say anything nice about her publicly. And she was just, oh. One of them was about girlfriend. like recipes she left in a crock pot, and they were so delicious she ate them every day and still makes those recipes. And Corey's like, yes. Oh my God. I mean, this is a woman that operates with the maturity of about a 10-year-old. And I'm thinking, if you really run everything through a filter and you go, well, how's Corey Richens going to react to this emotionally, mentally? It's about that of a prepubescent teen. Not much life experience, very reactionary, and about themselves. And that's pretty much, Corey Richens was like a 12-year-old girl on the stand. I mean, you look at some of the actions that she did as well. I wonder what your reaction is, Jen, and both of you can probably give me some insight into this, just how far any sort of questioning or points that Corey had made to authorities about people she didn't like. Because what we're finding out now in the charging doc, beyond her speech, was that leading up to the trial, she had all sorts of things that she was trying to deploy. She allegedly put the investigator, they made her and her flying monkey. He's allegedly made a dating profile, a fake dating profile on a gay website for the investigator. Again, feels like 1997 and a seventh grader, like doing a gotcha. There were so many other things as well in there that she allegedly did. Calls the FBI on the father-in-law for the guns he was just trying to secure that were Eric's. Calls DCFS on the parents that are watching the kids. She's trying to sick authorities on the people that don't agree with her. When authorities get those sort of calls and they discover they're all coming from the same place, the woman locked up, accused of doing these horrible things, how far do they actually investigate? Or is at some point just like, yeah, thanks for calling. We'll wait for the next one.
Well, you have to check the box.
Yeah.
You know, yep.
At least follow up and you're going to check the box and just make sure there's no truth to it. But like I always say, you have to consider your source of information. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, what their agendas are can really come into play, mm-hmm. on why they're providing the information like this. But the biggest thing this tells me, we are not done with Corey Richens. We are not done with her. Look for shenanigans in prison. Look for her hiring somebody to commit a murder. Look for a lot of hooch to be consumed. Look for this woman to be not out of the investigative limelight and not off of your show anytime soon. It's coming.
She's not going to. She's a lunatic. She's just a freaking lunatic. I mean, you know, so her desire, her. It's not even just a desire. Her nature, part of her genetic coding to control narratives, knows no bounds, because that's all she kept trying to do. So, and your analogy of saying she's like a middle school girl, and I don't want to put middle school girls down because you have one, Tony. And yeah. I mean, you know,
they're more mature.
Hugely much more mature. And I know you have teenagers too, Jen. I mean, everyone's kids are much more than this. This is, again, an abhorrent abomination of genetic coding. I'm going to go back to that one again because it's subhuman. You know, it's completely subhuman. It's a lunatic. There's like no species on Earth can even come close to this or probably in the universe. It's just like, that's why you got to sit back and watch a show. It's just a show because in order, we've seen this every now and then when we dealt with these crazies in school, when we're like in elementary school, not even middle school, right? Where their mind operates that the only way for me to win is to make sure everyone else loses because I suck at everything so bad. I can't elevate myself, so I'll just keep trying to put everyone else down. So I'm going to call the FBI. I'm going to call these people. I'm going to put out all these fictitious narratives out there so I can win by putting you all down. In other words, it's the completely opposite of all ships rise on a rising tide. No, I'm going to put myself on this pillar in the lake, and I'm going to drain the lake, and y'all are going to go out the flushed with it. So she's a lunatic.
Wait a minute. Abhorrent. I'm writing this down. Abomination of, did you say humanness?
Genetic coding.
Right.
I'm writing it down just for future.
It's my second time this week.
I did it earlier this week because I'm like, that's great.
who was I talking about when I said it the first time? Oh, that was David. Yeah,
it was David. Yeah,
it was David. David.
Yeah, abhorrent, you know, abomination of genetic coding.
Because some people just don't rate the title human.
Yeah,
and you got to come up with something else because Nutter. Yeah, she's a nutter, but Nutter's a term of endearment with some of these people at this point. You know, she doesn't even rate that. Lunatic is kind of getting there, but it doesn't. But lunatic is can be fun and whimsical, but you took a life, so that doesn't even count. So you gotta get grabbed deeper. Soul Ripper, not really there. It's a different category. So yeah, I have all these ones. I'm sorry, I'm digressing.
it really makes me wonder how much worse things actually were in that house.
Sounds bad.
Because look, what came to my mind, and I'm not trying to say anything negative about Eric at all. I'm really wondering what he knew was going on in that household when he was gone at work and Corey was taking care of the kids, and what stories he was being told about how she was caring for them, because these kids are talking about being locked in rooms, having animals starve to death around them, living in fear. And I mean, that doesn't seem like how Eric was. And the kids seem to have great things to say about dad. And, kids, these are little kids that are describing what, trying to, pull from their experience. And you're probably only getting a fraction of what actually went on. But I'm really wondering what the hell was going on in that house when Eric was at work and she was watching those kids. I'm going to guess probably exactly what she was saying. The kids were inconvenienced. They were locked in rooms. She wanted to be Joanna Gaines for a little bit of time, got animals, wanted to play the farm life, didn't want to care for them. They died. I mean, it sounds like part of my life that I went through because I can believe some of this shit. I learned a lot after I went through a divorce and that person left our lives. My daughter telling me stuff about like what would be going on in terms of when she was being cared for in the morning and like, I was just put in this room and given a bagel every day and I watched storks every day. I'm like, what are you talking? Like, that's not what I've been here. And it's like, oh shit. Kids can lie about things, but then you start to get into the details. It's like, I don't think they're lying. I think she was handling them and then giving Eric a bullshit story about what life was like when she was playing the role of mom.
And to Jen's opening point on this about she's not a mother, I'm sitting here listening to this. How could she not be on the floor in tears, devastated by what she failed to do as a mother?
I mean, she doesn't have that emotion.
Zero context of even trying to understand the context. And even if it was a mistake that you understand what you're... she should have been on that floor in tears, destroyed that her kids thought of that about her. Instead, she's rolling her eyes. Sorry, Jen, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, not at all. No, I was just going to say this. First of all, it was her children not looking bad. In other words, her children being dressed up in all the pictures we've seen and looking beautiful and all of that. That was very important, I think, for her psyche. And probably the only reason she didn't even do more harm to them. Also, but for her thinking she was going to get away with this, I would have not at all doubted her kids. One of them would have possibly shown up dead in the future. I just wouldn't have. I think this is somebody that thankfully was stopped and caught, because the problem is when somebody gets in your way, that is when somebody like that gets rid of them.
Yep. Did you see the one kid thought that he got some of the fentanyl on him? So one of the statements by one of the therapists said that one of the kids said that the one morning I went sick, mommy, it was because I think you actually had some of that fentanyl that you're using on dad on me. I mean, I'm paraphrasing right there, but one of the kids was actually accusing her of accidentally or having fentanyl in his system as well. It was crazy.
Which tracks, because the boyfriend?
Yeah, with the hot dog.
Well, he got really sick too, like right before. And the question is, like, what did she, like, I don't know that it was intentional on Corey Richens' part, if in fact she did poison the boyfriend too and her son. You know, I think that might have been, you know, residue or something.
It doesn't strike me as a hand washer, right?
No, not really.
Like, cross contamination, man.
Germs
in the kitchen.
Flee from me, and maybe
germs
too. I made
my Moscow Mule and sandwiches over here, but I'm not going to wash my hands when giving my boyfriend and my son their food. And it's just fentanyl. Yeah.
I know. That was an interesting revelation in that
it was.
Case. She still holds life insurance policies for two of the kids.
Jen, what?
She didn't care.
Exactly.
That never mind somebody like that. She didn't care. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's totally right. That's the answer. Like, that, you're exactly right. Because we can go on these diatribes of like, holy shit, can you believe this? And yeah, the answer is exactly that. She did.
That's why it doesn't register. It's why it doesn't register with her, because none of this registered with her. None of it. She just not even. She's not processing any of this as anything but a victim of everyone else.
She still has life insurance policies on two of the kids, which is disturbing enough. And you know, as you were saying, Jen, expect more things from her in prison. Can you? I don't. This is probably a legal question. Can you hold a life insurance policy on your living children while you're in prison? Is there any? I wonder if there's any laws against that, or if the insurance company can say we're going to cancel this right now.
I think as long as it's being paid on, I don't think it's any law. I mean, I think she can have that. I mean, the question is, who's she going to hire to try to off them? I mean, I am not even kidding.
No. I agree, because she's going to need money at some point, and she's going to need to find a way to get it, and that's a lever that, if available, could be pulled. Whatever insurance company better be looking for the name Corey Richens on their lists of clients and maybe make some new choices of who you're insuring.
Don't accept gifts from mom from prison.
No shit.
Oh, my God.
I just want to say, I want her in the same cell as Lori Vallow.
Oh my God!
That'd be great.
That should be a new series, man.
That needs to happen so bad. And then, you know, there's cameras, whatever. That would be very interesting.
I think it's a podcast. I think, you know, that, you know, you just put the two of them in a cell together and you broadcast it, and you charge $5.99 a month to watch it.
Just watch it.
You could fund the entire prison for indefinite amounts of time, because you'd have so many people watching that show. I mean, just, it's like hamsters in a cage. It's Corey and Lori, the adventures of Corey and Lori. You do after school specials. It'll be great.
And all proceeds to benefit the kids.
Yeah, I like that. I think it could
I'm looking up the life insurance policy thing right now.
Could be a winner right there. All right, that's going to wrap this up. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Go check out Jen's podcast, Break the Case, wherever you get podcasts, and on YouTube, and go press subscribe. Robin Drake, his latest book, go get this right now. It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books. We'll be sending you an autographed copy, Corey, in the mail.
I will. And yes, yeah, she can hold a life insurance policy from on them from behind bars.
Ooh, creepy.
Yeah.
Creepy. Oh God. I
don't take gifts from Corey.
Oh shit. Anyway, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue it there. Until next time, for Robin and Jen and Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.